So taking up a reasonably comfortable sitting position once again. Hopefully still keeping some connection with the collectedness, calmness, clarity of mind from the walking meditation. Maybe the degree of calm or clarity is not exactly the same, but there's still some continuity. And even though we take up the same sitting position, bringing attention, bringing awareness to the particular sitting position, we may notice some differences, say in the energy level of the body, degree of relaxation or tension. For some people, the walking meditation is quite energizing, for example. For others, for us more elderly folk, it might be more exhausting. But just try to tune into the condition of body right now at this time and place. Same posture maybe, but different experience of body. First of all, just observing what the condition is. For example, maybe some degree of fatigue. And then, it's generally more useful that the body has some degree of energy in it. So if we notice fatigue in the body, how do we cultivate more energy? Just by sitting here. One suggestion you might try is make sure the body is sitting upright. Is to try to put energy into the upright posture without straining. You could give a little bit more attention to the inhalation, generally more energizing. If you notice the body is tense, you can give a little bit more attention to the exhalation, which is more relaxing. Keeping this within the context of just the physicality of the body. And also learning to become more familiar with bodily sensation. And the first exercise the Buddha gave in awareness was to be more aware of the body. And we are able to do this directly through tuning into sensation. That is, being able to observe the sensations without interpretation. Sometimes our interpretation gets in the way of the direct experience. But just developing this ability to be aware of the body, we learn to read sensation without having to intellectually interpret it. You just feel it. The body, the body feels like this or senses like this. Heavy or light, relaxed or tense. And I get familiar with that direct experience. And then we turn attention to the sensation of natural breathing. As we focus on the breathing, notice if it's any different than it was last time. It's clearer or it's less clear. We're able to follow the breathing with more continuity, more collectedness and concentration. Or is the mind less concentrated? There's more distractions, more disturbance. Again, first of all, just to acknowledge it. Observe it. then perhaps we can expand our awareness to observe the possible conditions. What has caused that? And if you're doing walking meditation quite actively, stirs up the, gets the body energized, it can also stir up the mind. So the blood circulation is increased to the brain and is throwing off more thoughts. Or maybe you observe something when you're out there walking and you just, your mind is thinking about it. I want one of those trees for my garden. Where can I get that tree? Back to the breathing again. And then in relationship to the breathing, can you observe the condition of your mind? We observe the condition of body, sensations. Are you able to just observe what the condition of mind is? What's your mental weather at this moment? A little stormy? Is it a nice, bright, shiny day in your mind? Is it raining in your mind? Is it cloudy? And what kind of storm clouds are there? Reaching out, longing, wanting, desiring something, pushing, avoiding, rejecting something. Is it mind somewhat confused, uncertain, doubting, lacking clarity? Is it dull and sleepy and drowsy? Restless? Or maybe you can observe something else. Those are just the framework with the in regard to the five hindrances, but maybe something else is prominent. If it's hard to observe the state of mind, you know, there's the mind observing the mind, so sometimes it trips over itself. So let's go back to the breathing again. It's often easier to observe physical sensations than mental activity, which tend to go much quicker. And sometimes you can observe these states of mind reflected in the body. The mind is dull, the body feels heavy and sluggish. The mind has thoughts of desire or longing, and you can sense that in your body, wanting to get up and reach out and. Or what does something like aversion, maybe pushing away, feel like in the body? Contraction, perhaps. Or confusion, doubt, uncertainty. You notice any response in the body, if you acknowledge that in your mind. Be aware of the observing, the awareness of just what's there, and the interpreting of it. Interpretation is a bit noisy. The awareness is more quiet. That's the way it is. But maybe it's this. No, maybe it's that. Back to the breathing again. The breathing's just like this. attention back to the body once again, sitting here. Noticing how the body is at this particular time and place. And sensing it in the body itself, rather than going into your brain and interpreting it. And then you can relax your posture and open your eyes. So our basic reference is to the Buddhist teachings and to what we have of that in the Pali Canon. So in the Pali Canon, the body of Buddhist scriptures contained in the Pali language, there's two main approaches to the five hindrances. The first one is within the context of what's called calm meditation, samatha kamatan, development of concentration and deep concentration, the absorptions. And the second one is within the context of insight meditation, or formally the foundations or attendings with mindfulness. And they are related, they are handled or dealt with in two different ways. For calm meditation, basically the hindrances are temporarily suppressed. That's easy. I mean, in theory, temporarily suppress them. By emphasizing concentration on meditation object, the mind gets very, very focused, and then the hindrances just kind of fade away. You don't attend to the hindrances. If you can, if you have good concentration. The other approach in insight meditation is to observe the hindrances. The Buddha says to observe the hindrance, investigate its cause, what leads to its cessation, and the conditions that allow this hindrance not to arise again in future. So in fact, you're not just suppressing them, you're engaging with them, of course, skillfully. Doesn't mean indulging in them. Engaging with them to investigate them very clearly. And this can be, you know, this can be quite a refined process, because sometimes maybe the hindrance you observe initially isn't the real hindrance. You know, for example, many times what we observe first is just aversion. Huh? Aversion to a hindrance. Anybody love their hindrances? You desire your hindrances? Anybody? Well, maybe desire. Desire, but most of us would probably be averse to our hindrance. So there, first of all, the first hindrance you might observe is aversion, but it's aversion to another hindrance, which is the real basic one. You know, for example, something like doubt. I mean, well, they're all not very nice, are they? You know, do you love your lethargy and sleepiness, drowsiness? That's, well, then, you know, some days, maybe Saturday morning. It is a holiday, right? But maybe you have something like sleepiness and drowsiness, and then you react to it with aversion. And aversion is a bit more dynamic and a bit more obvious than lethargy, you see? So it stands out, and you think, I got a problem with aversion. So then you try to deal with the aversion, but really the basic hindrance, the foundation of it is lethargy, maybe. So you're kind of wasting your time by shadow boxing with aversion, see? When really, if you look more closely, you investigate more deeply in the body and the mind, then you begin to acknowledge, hey, this is lethargy, this isn't aversion. It's just throwing off aversion as a shadow to it. So the investigation of these hindrances is very important, and this can take some time maybe. And you get a sense for it, and this is why I mentioned this exercise. You need to kind of cross-reference, I would say. It could seem to be aversion in your mind, but look at your body. You know, how does aversion react? How does aversion respond? Or how do you experience aversion in the body? And you learn to read the body, you get a good cross-reference, a reality check, physically and mentally. So this can help you to get more clarity with regard to what the real hindrance is, basically. And then this may require some, you know, the second stage is to investigate the cause of it. You know, I mentioned that the principle of cause of kamma-vipaka, cause and effect. This is one of the Buddha's key insights was into the principle of causality, or cause and effect. Where other teachers at the time, they found a soul or a self, the Buddha investigated, and he didn't find any self, didn't find any soul. He just saw the laws of cause and effect. So, you know, aversion, you notice something like aversion in your mind? It's not your problem. Okay, well, it's your problem now, but the cause of it is cause and effect. There's principles there. There's some causal sequence that has set up this particular expression within your body-mind. Rather than think it's a personal problem, look at the causal processes here. What's triggering it off? What's the basis of it? And the Buddha does go into, especially for sensual desire and aversion, the Buddha goes into some very deep psychological processes. I don't want to get too technical here. Wait for the book. But one of the fundamental ones the Buddha emphasized, it's a little bit of a technical term, but the Buddha emphasized how important this is. It's called I translate it as appropriate attention. What we attend to has a very, very powerful effect upon our mind, you see. You know, if you say you attend to something not so attractive, something negative, well, this will influence your whole mental makeup. You know, for example, something like aversion. If you did have an experience where you were hurt by somebody and you keep dwelling on it, what happens? It gets louder and louder and deeper and deeper, and then you go up and strangle the person. Maybe. Well, hopefully, no, we're Buddhist, right? But you can see how it can just build up in your mind by dwelling on it, you see? And the same with desire. You know, beautiful things come along, and then a thought of desire arises, and then you, oh, I like that, I want that, how can I get that? And keeping it, when you keep attending to it, it gains energy, it gains momentum. It becomes imprinted upon your mind, and then it becomes an obsession. And before, all it was just a vague impression of something beautiful. These flowers here, you know. Come back in a week. Yuck, they stink even. But when you look at it, you get that impression, powerful impression, and then you start to dwell upon it, thinking about it again and again and again. Then you come back and for reality check, and hey, well, it's not quite so nice as I thought it was. So appropriate attention, yoniso manasikara in the Pali language. It's not mentioned too often because it's a bit technical term, but and this relates to the whole perceptual process, what you attend to. So, for example, using a meditation object which is very uplifting or very calming, to keep attending to it, supports concentration. And if you were to give your attention to a meditation object which was not very, you didn't have any affinity with, it was not very attractive, didn't appeal to you, it'd be hard to get concentration. You could, in theory, with enough perseverance, yes, but take a lot of effort. Where if you attend to a meditation object which you have some affinity to or is calming or supportive of calm, then you can perhaps much quicker get concentration. And this applies to all of our mental processes. You know, and unfortunately, the nature of a human being is that we tend to be more vigilant of so-called negative things or threatening things than positive ones. Now, this is what somebody called the negativity bias. Some neuroscientist, who's a meditator, by the way, he pointed out the negativity bias. When you have some hurt, for example, you dwell upon that hurt much more than the apology afterwards, you see. And so you just keep compounding it. But if you begin to understand how your mind is being impressed or is being conditioned by these processes, you can learn to undo it and free yourself from it. So to become aware of these particular, you know, where these hindrances arise from, what the cause is. First of all, if you have enough calmness of mind to observe what the hindrance is more clearly, then try to expand your awareness. Now, what's supporting it? What's triggering it off? What's keeping it going? And then when does it pass out, fade away? What are the conditions that don't allow it to arise? Something like the sleepiness or the dullness. And does it come at 11 o'clock on Saturday morning, or every Saturday morning? or just practically, some people have more energy in the morning. Some have more energy in the evening. Well, if you're practicing on your own, I would suggest you try and tune into your biorhythms. If you're a morning person, maybe do more meditation in the morning, because then that's when your body is more awake and alert and energized. If you're trying to meditate in the evening when you're tired all the time, okay, you can do it, but probably you get disappointed and have to face despair first, get through despair first. Don't get any feedback, any payback for it. So to be able to tune into your body and your mind, what's really going on there? It probably requires some humility as well as clarity. I thought there was one meditation manual that I was reading when I was in Thailand, and the kind of theory is, if you find out what your temperament is, you can find the meditation object to use. I looked at these temperaments: greed temperament, aversion temperament, delusion temperament, for example. I thought, okay, which one? I'm all three. At different times of the day, or different times of the week, fortunately. But so you may notice different hindrances at different times, you see. And I mean, to be able to actually observe them as clearly as possible, that's very, very significant and important. And then when you can be more clear about it, then it's easier to recognize what the cause is, what the triggers are, see? And then what allows it to fade away as well. So I think I better leave some time for questions. You got 5 minutes, 4 minutes. But is reasonably clear enough? Is it too abstract? Not detailed enough? Too detailed? How about if you investigate, and then tell me, and I'll check it later, see if we're on the same wavelengths. Yeah, am I getting out of the question, or is that helpful for you?
No, I'll investigate.
Yeah. Hopefully, maybe looking at it that way, it comes out of your head. You see, we know the theory of it, we know the definition, but it's important to be able, I would say, to get back to the feeling level, the sensing level of it in the body, and our intuition, if you like, to fill out our experience. We can look in the dictionary and find out what anger is, but do you know what it is as a personal experience? And each one of us has our own kind of anger. I won't get too personal here.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think Amazon.com. No. Depends where you live, I guess. You live here? Yeah, I think Brock will get some. Yeah. It's printed in Malaysia, so the group that prints it also has taken on the task of shipping it to all the monasteries, all of our monasteries around the world, so I think Birkin's on the list, I think. It's also would be, I think it would, sometime it would be an e-book on forestsanghapublications.org. I don't know if it's right now it's done, but it eventually will be an e-book. Human beings are very complicated. I wouldn't like to generalize. You know. Yeah, yeah. And I think it's more valuable that we, first of all, if we can tune into what our issue is at this time, and then maybe using this model the Buddha's given us, you know, investigate what the causes are. You know, and it allows us to approach it as an experience rather than just having it figured out. I know it's not, you know, not so easy, but I think it's more valuable. And like I think I mentioned it, you know, maybe you can, even you observe some of these, you know, issues we have that don't fit neatly into these categories, but if you kind of broaden out your perspective on it, you can see the energetic of it and maybe apply it to some of these basic principles that the Buddha gave how to work practically with these hindrances. So you notice a hindrance, but then you react to it. You don't want to.
Well, I think I believe. I'm more likely to believe it.
Get caught in it. You mean?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then less likely to go, okay, well, let's work our way out of this. Or,
yep. Yep. That's why maybe you just have to go back to the breathing,
right,
and establish a deeper level of calm, like, you know. Generally, the process is something like people, they take up the exercise of watching the breathing, and then they notice a few distractions. And then, you know, I mean, there is a whole series of ways to deal with what's called the discourse on distracting thoughts. So there's a way to work with them. You know, for my rule of thumb is that if a distraction comes back three times, then it's getting serious. You got to look at it, you know, not just to watch the breathing and ignore it, but I have to watch it, look at it, so just glance at it, what is it? And sometimes just the first observing, oh, this is irritation, and oh, you can drop it. Other times it's got a lot more energy to it, more history to it, a longer story, and then I have to investigate a bit more deeply what's the whole of this, rather than just that one particular thought maybe, or one particular reaction. But the basis is that if you have enough calm and clarity, you can. And with that understanding that only by understanding the cause of it are we able to really resolve it, not by just ignoring it, then we have that understanding and that persistence and that reference to calm and clarity. We can keep bringing these in and opening up to it, and physically, mentally, and hopefully get another perspective on it rather than just our usual habitual reaction to it. That's a long story. The experience is much longer than the explanation. but once we learn the principles, we can apply it to basically everything. Once you learn the basic principles, everything that comes up, everything is getting grist for the mill then. When you notice the story happening, just go back to the breathing. Just try to disengage from the story, because if you go into the story, you're just going to keep the story going. Write a new chapter, which is not helpful. So back to the breathing, back to the breathing to calm the mind, to be able to observe what's really going on there. You know, who's writing the story? Yeah. Where did the story start off from? Yeah. Which is not, is you can say, you know, it's not being in the story writer, but being the observer of how the process is going on. And this is important, that it's coming from a place of calm and clarity. The more calm and clarity you have, the more you're able to see, you know, the writing process rather than the writer all the time, you see. So if you notice yourself getting caught in the more stories, more proliferating about the story, back to the breathing again. Just keep it simple, back to the breathing, which will allow the mind to settle, maybe get some little bit of space between the writer and the story. Then you can observe the processes there. What are the causal processes rather than the personality involved in it? Is that helpful? Yeah. You got an afternoon yet to try it.